The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out to Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. All right, everybody. Well, welcome today to Bees in the News. This is going to be episode 15. Today, we've got articles coming from, we've got Pennsylvania, Sweden. We got in the U.S. via the FDA, Canada, and I think that might be about it. So let's jump into it right here. This first article is coming to us from the Genetic Literacy Project. Hidden threat to wild bees? Honeybees, including those raised by well-meaning suburbanites and city-dweller hobbyists, believing they are helping the environment. Canada is home to more than 800 species of wild bees. Few may have noticed the diversity of native bees buzzing around, but bees play a significant role in the survival of native plant populations. With environmental changes, habitat loss, pesticide use, and pathogen spillover, some of our native bees are in decline. Our research takes place along a section of the Niagara Escarpment, which features a huge diversity of native plants, many microclimates, and lots of natural land that makes ideal habitats for wild bees. The vast majority of wild bee species are rare. More than 200 species live in the habitat-rich forest, fields, and neighborhoods around Hamilton and McMaster University, where they are the subjects of our research. So I'm not going to read the whole article, but the takeaway here, it discusses the impacts of well-doers, like a lot of people who say, hey, look, I want to keep honeybees because I want to save the pollinators and all this. And then people flood different areas and communities with all of these non-native bees. And then you're introducing a lot of competition, potential disease, and other things that really make it much more difficult for native species that were actually doing just fine on their own. So it goes on to discuss, you know, the impacts to the wild bees. So it's a good read. So the next article was shared by a member of our Discord community. I think this one came from Eric. The FDA, so in the U.S., this is going to be the Food and Drug Administration, FDA approves first nasal spray for treatment of anaphylaxis. So in the unlikely event that you may not know what anaphylaxis is, this is just a body's hyper-allergic response to something, whether it be a food allergy, a bee sting, or anything else along those lines. Now, typically, when we have any kind of a mild reaction, it ends up being people will take like Benadryl, or if things get, you know, really bad where they're noticing that the reaction is a little bit more than it maybe should be, that's where people will go to what they call the EpiPen or the epinephrine pen. This is an auto injector. You jam it into your thigh. It shoots a syringe into the meaty muscle of your thigh. And then it injects the epinephrine into your body. And then you feel like you just saw the big bear and it scared the crap out of you for, you know, a few more minutes. Your heart rate's going through the roof. And anyway, that auto injector really was kind of the only option that we've had for a long time for, you know, these acute anaphylaxis kind of situations. But today, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Neffy, N-E-F-F-Y, an epinephrine nasal spray for the emergency treatment of allergic reactions type 1, including those that are life-threatening, anaphylaxis, in adult and pediatric patients who weigh at least 30 kilograms, about 66 pounds. Today's approval provides the first epinephrine product for the treatment of anaphylaxis that is not administered by injection. Anaphylaxis is life-threatening, and some people, particularly children, may delay or avoid treatment due to fear of injections, said Kelly Stone, MD, PhD, Associate Director of the Division of Pulmonology, Allergy, and Critical Care in the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. The availability of epinephrine nasal spray may reduce barriers to rapid treatment of anaphylaxis. As a result, Neffy provides an important treatment option and addresses an unmet need. Feel free to, again, drop in, check out the article, but I want to take a couple minutes and talk about this because this is really, really important. So there aren't really a whole lot of things in the world that I can think of that are more scary than feeling your throat constricting and feeling your ability to breathe and move air into and out of your lungs slipping away. I, thank God, have not had to experience that, but I can only imagine. I think it's really important for everybody out there who is either thinking about getting into beekeeping or maybe is just at the very beginning of it. One, if you have the means to do so, I strongly encourage you to go and get allergy tested. Go ahead and go through the process. It's not that big of a deal. I've had it done before. Figure out what your body is and is not allergic to right up front. That's number one. Number two, I recommend, even if you've been stung before and had no reaction at all, I recommend that you always have an EpiPen on hand in case, one, in case something changes in your status, or two, somebody that is around you or with you or near you happens to, for whatever reason, get stung, and then they're like, oh crap, I just got stung and I'm allergic, and you've got your EpiPen right there and you can intervene. This is not, I can't stress enough how important that this is. And I'm going to tell you two stories here about people who are members of our Discord, part of our podcast community, and then you can kind of decide for yourself what you want to do. One member was very active a couple of years ago. I've talked to him a few months ago. He's got a lot of stuff going on with his work and other things, but was very, very active in our Discord room last year. Had a chance to meet up with him, have dinner one night at one of the local bee conferences. Super guy. He was doing an inspection one day, got stung, no big deal, but his body's immunoresponse was much more active than it was in any previous sting. Now, I don't know if that's the right technical way to describe it, but instead of just getting a small little bump and that being it, he had a lot of swelling and hives, and it covered a big area, and he was really, really concerned about this. Now, he did go. He got a scheduled appointment. He went and saw an allergist. Now, I honestly don't remember. It's been a little while what the final outcome was. I think that he does have some level of sensitivity. He just needs to pay attention and be more careful about it, and it's not necessarily the end of the world. But this, and he knows who he is. If I'm wrong, shoot me a message, man, and let me know, and I'll update everybody. But this next one is really, really, I'm shocked by this, that this happened. And I really, this is why I'm glad to have the opportunity to tell you all about it. There is a gentleman who was in our Discord room and, you know, listener of the podcast. He sends, you know, a message one day and he's like, hey, I heard you talking. I think we might be neighbors. Turns out we are. So, you know, we're chatting it up one time. We talk about oxalic acid, and you know, he's asking some questions about recommendations for treatment or whatever. And I said, look, I got the machine. I'll just come over and I'll just knock it out for you. And he's like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, no problem. So I go over and I have his bees on a course of oxalic acid treatment for about 3 weeks. And, you know, we come over, you know, once every 4 or 5 days, did some treatment. And one day he sends me a message and he's like, hey, you're not going to believe what happened. I'm like, well, what's up? And he goes, yeah, I had to go to the ER last night. And I said, like, what happened? And he says, I was walking in my driveway and I stepped on a bee. Right? Like, no big deal. I mean, obviously you don't want to kill a bee if you don't have to, but I mean, you know, bee was in the driveway. He's walking by, steps on it, gets stung, pulls a stinger out, goes on about his day. Well, he goes into his house and within a few minutes, he's getting, you know, getting the hives, getting itchy hands, getting all the symptoms of, you know, the beginning of an allergic reaction. And so he tells his wife, like, hey, you need to call 911. So she calls 911. He grabs the EpiPen. He administers the EpiPen to himself and he's hanging out, you know, waiting for the ambulance. He goes to the hospital. They get everything figured out. Now, I don't know what meds they gave him at the hospital. I mean, lots of times they'll dump, you know, Benadryl or diphenhydramine, or they'll throw some, maybe some Solu-Medrol sometimes. But anyway, whatever they're going to give, they did what they had to do to make sure he was okay. He goes and sees his allergist, and his numbers are through. He sent me like a screenshot of his allergy results and something, for example, like there was like a honeybee section and it said that it should be less than one. And his number was like 99, something like that. So he had no idea. He had worked in the bee yard before. He had been stung before, and it wasn't an issue, but it was an issue at this point in time. Now, this is an area, and I've been trying. I reached out to my old allergist. She didn't get back to me. If you or somebody on the podcast here is an allergist and wants to get on and talk to us, please let me know. But I'll explain it as best as I can remember. There are multiple components to allergy and allergic response and immunoresponse. You basically have like for example, with the honeybee, you have like the actual venom exposure, and then you have another exposure being more of like the, I guess like the bee itself, almost like if you were to think about like, and I'm kind of, you know, bear with me here on this one, but it's thinking like an animal. Like an animal has like pet dander, and there's like pet things from the animal that are left around by the animal. It's the same kind of thing. Cause I think I've heard before where like a beekeeper's family is like 10 times more likely to be allergic to honeybees than the beekeeper themselves, because the beekeeper is exposed to all the things that are the chemical signatures of bees, and they're also getting stung. Whereas the family members might just be like washing the laundry or, you know, come in contact with parts and pieces, but never actually get stung. So that's my goofy, not accurate way of trying to describe it, the fact that there's multiple components to it. So I think that that's where, and I've seen, I think Michael Palmer has mentioned it. Other people have mentioned like the importance of getting stung. I feel like I should add this to my list. Once I figure this out, once I get a good handle on this from a technical medical standpoint, I will do a video explaining exactly how this works and why it's important to get stung. But the key takeaway on all this here, because I know I've been rambling for a long time about this, the key takeaway on all of this is whether you think you are allergic or not, whether you've had a reaction or not, please try to get an EpiPen. Okay, so this article just talks about this new nasal-based, nasal form of administration for epinephrine. So we'll see how that works out. That's pretty cool. I think that's definitely a lot better. There are a lot of people that are just scared to death of the idea of the EpiPen. You know, they don't want to get that big auto-injector, you know, jammed into their thigh. Now, there is something to add to this. I mean, for a nasal spray, I don't know. I haven't read the labels, but my thought is the person probably at least needs to be conscious to administer it. But anyway, so that's good to have some more options out there. Okay, so the next article is coming to us today from Entomology Today, brought to you by the Entomological Society of America. Combining pest treatments may be key to helping honeybees survive the winter. Now, this one, I'm not actually going to read any of this one. I'm going to give you a little bit of a synopsis for it, and then you can go check it out yourself. But basically, what's going on in this article is the suggestion is, let's say that you are an Apigard person or Formic Pro or whatever your chosen Varroa treatment is, and you just use one. Like, for example, I just use oxalic acid. That's just, it works for me. That's what I use. But it's not necessarily the right thing for all situations. And I'm not going to go into the whole deep dive on why that is, but there are some situations where you need a kind of an immediate heavy blast to knock down, you know, it's a little bit of a harsher treatment, more of a chemical based treatment, where there are also times where you can be a little bit more gentle and have an easier approach. And sometimes, you know, things are just so overwhelmingly tough for the bees that you have to get a little aggressive. So the case being made in this article and from the research they've done is, hey, you kind of need to have a couple of different things to really have maximum effectiveness in your treatment for Varroa. So it's definitely an article worth checking out. And again, this is from the Entomology Today website. And as always, these links are all going to be on the Beekeeping for Newbies homepage under the In the News section, so you can check that out. Next one comes to us out of Penn State, Pennsylvania. HiveMind. Penn State researchers track over 400 native bee species in Pennsylvania. Close your eyes and think of a bee. A honeybee or a bumblebee probably came to mind, but there are 435 other species native to Pennsylvania and 20,000 worldwide. It just kind of goes to show you how diverse bees are across the world and why they're so important to learn about and research, said Sarah Kanya, a researcher with Penn State's Department of Entomology, during a presentation Tuesday at Ag Progress Days. Kanya is part of a team of researchers that's working with Penn State Extension Master Gardeners to increase understanding of Pennsylvania's native bee population. The Pennsylvania Bee Monitoring Program, started in 2021, works with about 20 counties throughout the state where volunteers collect bees to be sent back to the research lab for identification and further study. About 300 bee species have been gathered so far. While honeybees and bumblebees are the most well-known species, they are relatively unique in terms of how they live. Both species are very social, living with the queen and hives. They also are both generalized pollinators, meaning they will collect pollen from almost any plant. That's why they're so great for agricultural pollination, Kenya says. They will go and pretty much pollinate anything they see. The other bee species in the state are much more solitary, living relatively alone in cavity nests or ground nests, and often more specialized in which plants they will collect from. About 30% of Pennsylvania's bees are cavity nesters, leaving the other 70% to nest in the ground. So anyway, kind of an interesting article. I really didn't know there were that many species of bees in Pennsylvania. And there's not much more to it, but it's definitely worth a read here. And the final article for the day today comes to us from a company called Berg Insight. They are based out of Gothenburg, Sweden. How connectivity transforms the beekeeping industry. Now, this is something I've actually talked about myself that I want to do in my beehives. I want to have the ability to have a device of some sort sitting either outside the hives with sensors going in or individual devices in all of the hives. But the vision that I have is that I would be able to hold a device in my hand, walk down the rows of honeybees, and every device there sees my tablet or whatever the device is and says, oh, I need to send a report. And it automatically uploads a bunch of data. Or even better, if I can have, let's say I had 100 hives, every 10th hive was a collector, and the collector hives would just automatically send data to me somehow via Wi-Fi or other kind of connection. But being able to aggregate data around temperature, humidity, other conditions, I think that is really, really cool, particularly at the larger scale when this is a, you know, this is something that is your living. This is what you do to sustain your family and put food on the table and, you know, meet your obligations as a seller, as a pollinator, whatever the case might be. So a lot of these are done, or a lot of the technology that drives this, I should say, is done with something called IoT. If you're not familiar with IoT, it means Internet of Things. And I have no idea why they gave it that name. I think it's a pretty stupid name. But what these devices do is they essentially connect some kind of capability to your device or a means by which you can read or gather data. So a quick example, you take an IoT light bulb and you screw that light bulb into a light fixture somewhere in your home. You bring up an app, and now via the app, because your phone is connected to your local Wi-Fi, the light bulb, the IoT light bulb is connected to your Wi-Fi. Now you can tell the light bulb, I want you to come on at 6 a.m. every day. I want you to go off at 9 a.m. I want you to come back on at 6 p.m. and go off again at 11 p.m. You can set schedules, timers. There are other IoT devices that, as an example, let's say you have an HVAC unit, and that HVAC unit has a tray where all the condensation water builds up, and that water is supposed to go down the drain and go outside the house. But if it gets to a certain level, it can trigger an alarm. That alarm can trigger and send a notification to you saying, hey, your AC water tray is about to overflow. You need to unclog whatever's going on. Now, they have systems in place now. When that happens, it just shuts off the HVAC system and your house gets really hot and you got to go figure out why. But anything that you can think of, whether it be an alarm system or like a Ring doorbell, a Ring doorbell is kind of an example of like a IoT type device, basically. Somebody walks up, presses the doorbell, it sends a notification over Wi-Fi to an app. You have the app, you get the notification, and you talk to the person at the doorbell. They do them with outlets, smart outlets. There's all kinds of things that can be IoT enabled. I got crap inside my refrigerator and my stove now. I'm like, God, do I really need this? But that's a whole separate thing. Anyway, I wanted to give you a little bit of an IoT background before we jump in here. The bee population has been declining during the last decades, and beekeepers report increased bee colony loss rates worldwide. This implies a global threat since human survival depends on pollinators such as bees. Bees are crucial for biodiversity and health, promote sustainable agriculture, and are important pollinators for food crops. To ensure bee survival and facilitate beekeeping, technology and IoT can be utilized. The introduction of IoT in the beekeeping industry enhances bee survival. Beekeeping is the practice of managing and maintaining bee colonies and beehives. Honey is the main product beekeepers generate through beekeeping. I'm going to fast forward a little bit to get to the IoT piece of this. By utilizing IoT, connected beehives gather data to analyze the bee colony's status and provide valuable information about the bee health to the beekeeper. As a result, the beekeeper can remotely monitor the bee colony's status and provide appropriate actions accordingly. The data can be collected through multiple sensors inside or outside the hive, such as cameras, audio, humidity, thermometers, and scales, as well as additional information strengthening the analysis, such as weather data. Thereby, it is possible to monitor bee health issues such as the loss of the queen, starvation, and infestation of mites. Connected beehives enable these issues to be managed and avoided, promoting healthier bee colonies with higher survival rates. Additional information to be monitored includes nectar and pollen flows, food levels, and honey production amount. So it goes through to talk about multiple companies that offer different types of things. I see they have a picture in here of a camera that looks really super expensive. So I'm going to put this on my like 5-year plan, because as like most things, I'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going to try and look at this next year maybe. And then like 3 years later, I haven't even thought about it. So maybe in the next 5 years, I'll pull out a little chip or a board or a Raspberry Pi or one of those little ESP32 chip things and see what I can make. But that's going to be back burner because I have so much other stuff that's got to get done. But there are many benefits to be gained from using connected beehives. Multiple benefits and values are created by connecting beehives. Firstly, beekeepers who monitor their beehives remotely can visit them only when required, enabling them to save much time by reducing the number of manual inspections. This is important for beekeepers with many beehives spread across various locations, since they must drive around to inspect all the apiaries. So the tougher part with that one is with connectivity, because I mostly see beehives outside of those that are at somebody's house. A lot of times they're just randomly in the middle of a field somewhere. So what are you going to get, like a $50 a month cell phone plan so that you can report bee data? I mean, I guess you could. Maybe it's cheaper to do that than it is to drive to them all the time. But anyway, definitely a cool topic to discuss. And I think at some point in time, like all things in technology, if you're the first one to adopt it, it's going to cost you $10,000. And within 5 years, it's about $50. So we'll see how that continues to develop. And we'll see how, you know, who comes up with something that's cheap. Well, folks, that is all that I've got for you today on our In the News segment. If you've come up with something that you think is important that you'd like me to include in a future segment, feel free to send me a link to the article. If you're in the Discord room, we have an In the News section, so you're always free to post something in there. And just like Eric did on the FDA article, we'll do the same thing with yours if it meets all of our criteria. And outside of that, I'm good to go, folks. I got nothing else for you. We got a few more episodes coming out here, I think, this week, mostly on the YouTube side of things. So please check us out over there, and don't forget to very, very gently tap that like button and subscribe if you find some value to the videos. If you don't find any value in the videos, please let me know why so I can do a better job. All right, folks, take care, be kind to one another, and don't ever forget that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.